sound set.
The Disciplined Investor is all about you, your money, and the markets. Sit back and get ready for this edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
This episode of the Disciplined Investor is sponsored by Horowitz & Company. If you're looking for a portfolio manager, look no further. Horowitz & Company, from seed through harvest, cultivating financial success.
U.S. markets hit an all-time high. Governments back open. Google flies, IBM dies. And we have a guest with us today, the watchdog on Wall Street. His name is Christopher Markowski. All this and much more on episode number 335 of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. Well, hello, and thanks for joining me at episode number 335. Been doing this a long time, and thanks for hanging around, joining me, and spending the time with us, learning and growing as we do. And thanks so much for all of your email and your comments. And we'll get to some of those just generally in a moment. We're going to talk about the markets hitting an all-time high. And here we are in October, seemingly the worst month of the year, supposedly. And we started off a little bit questionable. And there was some big concern about the government shutdown. And, of course, the big hoo-ha about the debt ceiling. And the Republicans were out for blood. But they got whacked. I mean, I got to tell you something. From a political standpoint, I don't know what they were trying to do. I get that there was some decision to really try to fight this whole thing and really dig in to see if they can get any changes made. But when they made the comment into the second week of the government shutdown that they will not allow the country to default and to necessarily have any problems when it comes to the debt ceiling, it was over. They had nothing else to play. They had nothing else that was really up their sleeves, because the only concern that there was, I suppose, was that we would have some kind of default and a cataclysmic domino effect on fixed income and all sorts of issues around the world. And what ended up happening was they pretty much screwed it up. I'm not saying what they did was right or that I'm even agreeing with, but what they did was played their hand incorrectly. And I got to tell you that they're looking pretty bad. As a matter of fact, I think that overall Congress's approval rating is at an all-time low, and the Republicans themselves are looking pretty bad as a total group, even though some of the discussion is that it was just a Tea Party. But, you know, I got to tell you something. It doesn't matter. It doesn't matter. You know, stand up for what you believe and stick to it, whatever it is. Because if not, you're going to end up with a mess like you're doing now, being wishy-washy, being floppy, waffling, whatever you want to call it. What they've done is just create, not uncertainty, disgust. I don't think there's anybody listening right now that would say that they're in favor of how this whole thing was handled. And at the end of the day, we could see that when it came to the markets, because once this whole thing was just put to bed, and at least there was a delay into when the thing is going to come back up, and we're going to see this in January all over again. And I don't know what the Republicans and what the Democrats are going to plan. Right now, the Democrats feel like, hey, you know, we really won something really big here. And the Republicans are probably just pissed off and looking for some revenge, which is a really bad thing. If you want to do something good, do it. Otherwise, don't. And I'm not going to talk about it anymore. I will tell you, the market pretty much shrugged it off, even though there was a bit of, what, a 3% drop overall. And then it came back in style. I got to tell you, I was pretty surprised that there was that kind of move after there was an agreement that was just merely a postponement of the inevitable, or a postponement of whatever's going to happen next. Kicking the can down the road for another couple of months, 3 months, I don't know what that's going to buy anybody and what that's going to do, and if they can come up with a plan. They haven't done so in years, so why now? But here's the deal, that we saw that with the government shutdown, there was only a few economic reports released. This week coming up, some of the backlog of those releases will be actually put out there. So we'll see what's going on with the unemployment rate and a few of the other things, probably about a dozen or so that were held up. So this week, probably we're going to see just a whole bunch of economic numbers from the current week and from previous weeks. And we have earnings that we saw. A bit of a, I would say, a mixed bag. First, we have some of the banks that come out that did better, and you know, they generally did better. They had good outlooks. And then we saw the continuation of the J.P. Morgan saga, where J.P. Morgan was going to have to pay $10 billion, then $11 billion. Then there was some agreement to $2 billion, and there was a confusion at the end of the week as to really what they're going to have to pay. And over the weekend, J.P. Morgan, it seems, has reached an agreement that the fine they'll have to pay, the penalty on the mortgage-backed securities and the various securitized deals that they did that seemingly were not in the best interest of their clients, they're going to pay about $13 billion. $13 billion. That is unbelievable. I was at a charitable event this weekend, and it was a 70s party. It was pretty hilarious because all these people came in dressed up with these huckapoo shirts and these very tight pants with the elephant bottom and bottoms and the platform shoes and big afros. I mean, big. And the whole thing was theme was Studio 54. And it was really cool because it was done in the Parker Playhouse down here that was that is a theater. So you have all the theater rows and the stage. And I'm thinking, where are they going to have this party? Where are they going to have this event? They actually had it on the stage. They had about 250 people on the stage, and they had all sorts of music from the 70s and disco, and they had disco balls and lights and all this great stuff. Okay. Now, the whole idea was to raise money, of course, and they had a silent auction, and people gave, and they raised about, they were really excited, they raised about $50,000. And I tried to put that in context with the amount of fine that J.P. Morgan is going to pay. $13 billion in fines. And this group was happy to raise $50,000. The numbers just don't add up. How is J.P. Morgan paying $13 billion? And if they are paying $13 billion, which they said, how much were the real profits that they made on the various transactions that they only have to probably pay a portion of that in penalties? What I'm really curious about is if the news for many years was all about Goldman Sachs and a few other of the actors involved in this whole meltdown back in 2007, 2008, are they going after others? Are they going to keep on just banging down J.P. Morgan? And the other issue is that it's fascinating to look inside of the total penalty to see that, okay, this is how much is going to be having to be paid to the government because of their various penalties, et cetera. But the legal costs are absurd. Billions of dollars in legal costs for this deal. At the end of the day, here's the deal. J.P. Morgan will pay the $13 billion. And if they don't have enough money, they'll just borrow it free from the government. So it's just going to wash all the way around. So if anybody's worried about J.P. Morgan, because their stock really hasn't done anything in response to this massive potential claim that they have, well, the idea is that in the end, they're going to have money that they can use for essentially free, or as the Fed says, 0.25%. And what does that really hurt them? We're going to see what happens and how this all really plays out when it comes to the other banks, the big boys, that did the same thing. Because you have to think that there's going to be a lot of potential for that to be brought in. Now, the other thing that is really odd about some of this is that the banks were forced, quote unquote, to take on some of the companies that were failing. You know, we had these mergers that were forced on some of these banks. And now they have to pay for the transgressions of those companies that they took in. So I'm not sure where there's an equitable balance here between the forcing them to take the risk by bringing these companies in, because nobody should fail, of course, and then giving them money at extremely low cost and then hitting them for these fines. I don't know. It seems very, very strange, this whole setup. But we do know something. Something is very clear. We do know that at the end of the day, the Fed is going to protect the banks no matter what. The ECB is now drafting some new discussion about, Draghi said this the weekend, hey, you know what? There may be the current rule, if you take it very strictly, that there's going to have to be some losses that will be put on certain parties in the event of a loss of a bank and maybe the junior bondholders and shareholders of fixed income. But we don't think that really should be the case for when it comes to the ECB giving money, because if they do in fact default on some of their bonds, we shouldn't say that we're not going to give them any more money. So in other words, the ECB is willing to provide additional assets to the banks, even though they may default on some of the debt on the other side. Now, would you do that? Would you give money and lend money to somebody that you know is in active default recently with somebody else? Give fresh new money to a business if, in fact, you know that some of their debt is going bad? Better said, why in the world would individuals want to do this? And that's what Draghi is kind of wrestling with right now, of trying to do a balance between making sure the banks are stable, the individuals are giving money, and at the same time, no matter what, the ECB and various government agencies will continue to fund them in the event of any kind of a major crisis. It's very disturbing, frankly. It's just, it's disgusting. It's not a free market, but it is a market nonetheless. It is something that we need to pay attention to, and as we are seeing equities hit an all-time high and pretty much just not even think about the IBM numbers that shaved about 80 points that day off of the Dow Jones Industrials, and the Dow closed, you know, basically flat on the day when their numbers came out. But yet when Google comes out and beats by 10 cents and they have a decent quarter, the stock goes up 12%, the NASDAQ is up 1.3%, and it pulls the entire market up with it because everybody's just cheering. So when we look at the bad news, we don't really see anything too terrible because in the future things will get better. And the good news is an obvious, well, things are better. So therefore, we have a cup is full and full. There's not even a half full going on here, okay? Not even half empty or half full. It's just full. Cup is full. Always good. But IBM did, in fact, put in a pretty awful number. And this is after IBM has been continuing to buy back shares at just over the years, last, I don't know, 20 or 30 years. They've just been buying back shares and creating less and less liquidity and less availability of shares to be out there. And that did have a benefit to their EPS, the bottom line, but their revenues fell about $1 billion short. Not good. So they really had some problems, and I don't know what the distinction is other than the Goog had a good quarter, even though they had their click rate, the cost per click go down, but they had a lot more clicks. So a lot more people are using the internet, getting much more accustomed and acquainted and comfortable with utilizing the quote-unquote cloud-based type of environment, whether it's mobile, whether it's desktop, and maybe what's happening with IBM is some of the old-fashioned services and the hardware, the big mainframe concept, or at least some of the things they've done, really slowing down a lot because we're seeing this move into the next generation finally. So they're having a situation where it's starting to turn over. This exactly leads me into a discussion that I seem to be having more and more lately about the employment numbers. Because the whole idea of having a 4% unemployment rate back to quote-unquote normality is preposterous. And I'll tell you why. About 2 years ago, we wrote a piece called Consumption Cannibalism. Essentially, the idea behind it was that we were seeing the continuation of technology taking the positions away from individuals. So technology in any form would take away the position from a human being. For example, there's really not any reason anymore to have a file clerk, somebody who would run with files and grab them from a big filing area and bring it to a lawyer or a CPA, a doctor or individual or whoever it was, because now you have scanning technology and you have virtual storage, and you have all sorts of other ways of accessing that information. Now, you may have that person who is the file clerk or someone else in the scanning room. Then again, you may not need as many people because you can do a lot of that on an automated basis. So that job has been essentially obliterated. Maybe receptionists, you don't need them as much anymore because you have all sorts of high technology voicemail systems. You have them integrated with your CRM, you have them integrated with the company themselves, and maybe there's not as much of a need for that. Inventory trackers, okay. How about pickers at an Amazon, for example, or somewhere, a big factory, where you used to have people running through the factory, pulling the item, packing it up, shipping it out. Now you have facilities just doing drop shipments and third-party synchronization of the shipping from a particular warehouse, or you have some kind of a robotics that are actually pulling the package because they can scan it and pull it right off and then send it on their way. There's a whole, you could keep going on and on with this. Now, the thing is that technology doesn't have to eat, doesn't have to drink, doesn't buy any kind of clothes. They don't have to take vacations. They don't have unions. They don't need health care. And again, you can go on with that. The point is that all of a sudden there's this discussion about robotics, but robotics is only one portion of this whole issue. It's a much bigger issue. It's the issue where the person who was making pretzels on a line that made 50 per hour by folding them just properly is now replaced by a machine that can make 500 per hour. No vacations, no health care, no pension, no downtime. 24/7 if they want. Now, this is what is going to and has caused two things. Number one, the potential for a very serious structural unemployment situation. But the second side of this is great efficiency and better margins for companies. There's good and bad. Because now the fact is that while there is this greater benefit to companies, and the margins have been expanding on this to those companies that have embraced this, the rub is that individuals are no longer having jobs, therefore not buying as much. So it's the same thing that happened with Google, where they had more clicks, but yet the clicks per click were less. In other words, you may be selling less product now, but they're making more money per, so it does even out because of the technology and robotics. This is how you get to the title that I mentioned, the consumption cannibalism, because the more technology you have, the less people you have working, and therefore the less they are consuming. And the less they are consuming, the greater the margins have to be for profitability of a company. And that is why you have seen the rate and growth of revenues been dropping significantly over the last 24 months. This is one of the reasons. There's other reasons too. But this is a big issue. They're starting to pick this up on the major media. I've seen a few shows on this and discussions about this. They keep talking about robotics because everybody starts thinking about these robots walking around and these machinery. But really the whole issue is the technology and the efficiency that is gained by the technology. Look at a Rockwell Automation as an example of the robotics, for example. And there's other companies that are involved in much of the entire pipeline from manufacturing to distribution, all the way through sales, tracking sales, and making all of that much more efficient. This is one of the reasons why you don't see as many mom-and-pop restaurants around the country, and you have these big chains, because they can know exactly, on average, who's coming in to eat, how much they're going to eat. They could do pre-portioning and portioning control of the product. They can make it the same every single time, know their overhead, know their costs. And Chipotle, as an example, really did a nice job with that. They came out with their earnings on Friday as well. We're up 12% on the day on the stock. And it was an excellent earnings report with the fact that they're talking about now raising the rates on their menu, something they really avoided for a long time. So this is not only playing out just like we thought. There is one issue we haven't seen really the significance of any kind of the revenue really hurting the companies yet. That will come. It's starting to roll over a little bit now. Yet there's still a lot of euphoria about the fact that companies are beating EPS, but that is a natural process that happens when you have greater efficiency, doesn't it? Doesn't it make sense? So IBM is the poster child maybe for the old school, the older type of equipment that was needed to be put in as a baseline. And that was now, you don't need to really do a lot of repair of that, you know, that or rebuilds of that on a consistent basis once you get the thing really running pretty well. And then a Google, as a side note, is kind of the other side. And they may not be the best example, there's other ones, but a good example nonetheless. What I want to talk about in a little while, I want to talk about the VIX. I want to talk about a few stocks that are possibly setting up that are very interesting to take a look at. I want to talk about the KRI, the key reversal indicator, and tell you what that is doing. But first, we're going to get to our guest, and when we come back, we're going to talk about all of that. And I really want to talk about last week's episode as well, that I got some emails on, both on the good and bad side. But I want to kind of flush that out a little bit and talk about that. You know, I thought we'd do is we'd bring in someone who watches over, who is a consumer advocate, who, as he's called, the watchdog. And he is Christopher Markowski, and he is a radio show host. He's been on the air for about 14 years on about 150 stations around the country on the TRN network and from Watchdog on WallStreet.com. So I have a lot of questions for you, my friend.
All right. Fire away, my friend. Let's go.
So, listen, there's a lot of, let's just call it, you know, for lack of a better term, hanky-panky that's gone on Wall Street for a number of years. And one of the big things is that, as I've mentioned 100 times, you've really seen very little or no real criminal investigations. I mean, last week, SAC Capital, SAC Capital, came to an agreement with the feds about this insider trading. But what is the hesitancy, and why is it that it seems that there's such a lack of, you know, a crackdown on some of the bad things that go on?
Well, in my belief, a lot of it has to do with just how the system has been designed and how it works. We've got FINRA, which is a self-regulatory body, and we also have the Securities and Exchange Commission as well. And we also have to realize that securities laws are not written in black and white. It's not like the Ten Commandments where thou shall not do this or thou shall not do that. They're written in gray. And lawyers can have a field day with gray. Mm-hmm. Lawyers love gray areas because mm-hmm. they can get people swimming around for years and years and years. I mean, how many years did it take them to knock out Stratton Oakmont or Monroe Parker and all these other ones, Bernie Madoff,
right.
All these other places? Bernie Madoff was in business for 30 years. They had their eyes on him, for crying out loud.
Right.
Another thing is the revolving door over at a lot of these agencies as well. I mean, the Securities and Exchange Commission, anybody who is worth their weight in anything, they work there for a period of time and then they leave and they go work for some defense attorney on the other side. So many of these cases that they're working on go away, and a lot of the bright people leave. Unfortunately, our entire investing world is bastardized in many ways by the CNBCs, by a lot of these programs out there that want people to act not in their best interests. They try to convince people that you can, you know, you're going to see doubles and triples on your money. We don't have really much of a police force out there. And again, there's just human nature. There's fear and greed are the best baits that investment con artists have. And I've been saying for a long time, investment con artists are the world's second oldest profession.
Yeah, I mean, you know, you mentioned CMC. First of all, let me say something. I love the SEC. I just want to get that on the record in case anybody's listening. Okay?
I'm regulated by them, too. I mean, they come in and they do, you know, as best a job as they possibly can. But, you know, I mean, would you agree that, you know, shouldn't they have the same type of power like the FBI?
I would think so. I mean, they can get pretty intense and really tie you up for a while. There's no question about that. And my experience has been, to be honest with you, my experience has been good. I've had a few SEC, you know, what do they call them, the regular overviews that they come in, they sit down for a week or so, and they go through everything.
But they know that, you know, you're not up to anything. I have them, too.
Right, that's true.
It's very easy for them to come in and say, okay, look at, you know, their clients are making money. These people are doing a good job. Let's make sure that they've got their house in order. It's when they're going after the bad guys a lot of times where their hands are tied.
Well, of course,
very difficult.
The bad guys are obviously concealing something, and it's that's the whole point. And they're going to conceal it in a way that they hope to at least not get caught, and such as that they're going to then go after, you know, information that they, you know, a double set of books, for example, or something like that. But let me ask you a couple of things now about, you mentioned CNBC, and I find that kind of curious or interesting because, you know, I don't really watch it besides maybe one show every once in a while on there. But I complain quite often about them that the they seem to bring in people that talk about only a certain side of the business or a certain side of the argument, I should say. And then the information that comes out of there seems to be always silver lined, and it seems to be all happy. And if if we lose a million jobs, well, we could have lost 2 million, so it's really good. I mean, what is your take on that?
Well, I've had this theory for a while that I've been talking about, and I call it my watchdog on Wall Street axis of evil, and it includes the mainstream media, including CNBC, crony capitalists, including the big Wall Street firms, and Washington, and they work hand-in-hand to further their own needs. I mean, let's be honest, CNBC makes their money by selling advertisements.
Mm-hmm.
Do you ever really see them go after any of the real crooks or fraud or what goes on there? I mean, come on. I mean, you can take a look at all these big investment houses, and I've written story after story of all the terrible things that they've done, but they have no problem bringing their people on the air. They're their buddies. They're good pals. They're going to bring them on. No one really takes a look at what their performance really is, not to mention the fact that, I mean, is it really prudent to be out there saying, well, oh, you know what, this mutual fund has outperformed everybody else over the past 3 months? What idiot invests in a mutual fund for 3 months?
Well,
I mean, everything that they're teaching and pushing here is just, it's insanity.
Right. It's instant gratification, and it is all about kind of what sells, the hot thing, hot topic for the day. Now, let's kind of switch up a little bit. There's so many different things that I can talk to you about. The whole idea that the government is, I don't know, it's, you know, it seems to have an unlimited amount, not the government, the Fed, has an unlimited amount of money that they are willing to continue putting up. The one thing that I've struggled with for a long time is how, not really when, but how do they ever stop this? And, you know, you've mentioned things that we've written back and forth about when it become the next Weimar Republic and things like that. I mean, kind of go through some of that and what your thoughts are.
Well, I think that some of the people that are out there saying that, you know, we've got to have this hyperinflation type of environment, I've been saying that, well, where you been, man? Have you taken a look at the price of commodities over the past 10 years? They've gone through the roof. They've blown away everything else out there.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I don't go to the grocery store. It's not my contract in my household. We've got division of labor. Thank God my wife does that. But I see the bill.
Yeah.
And I see what it costs, and I most certainly realize that the price of food has gone up. And for the first time ever, we had the price of gasoline, an average price over $3 a gallon for over 1,000 days straight. I mean, come on already. We're already in a hyperinflationary type environment. The problem is, the other thing is the government's saying that we're not, because the price of flat-screen TVs have come down.
Well, that's
gifty do. You can't eat them.
Yeah, you can't eat them, but you can watch them till you drop. But listen, so what's interesting about this conversation, though, is that we have data that comes out that says that there is no inflation. Of course, you have to exclude a few things, but there's no inflation, okay, by the quote-unquote official numbers. And it seems that all that we're really concerned about on Wall Street, I'm talking about now, is the official numbers. Because I know as well as you do, like you said, that there is no inflation, but everything costs me more. You know, that's my standard line. I mean, there's no inflation, but it just so happens that everything costs a lot more money now. And what I find interesting is the same thing happens, for example, with China. So China puts out numbers, and we find out, there's a lot of skepticism about it, what are you going to do about it? They themselves announce, hey, there's something wrong with these numbers. The import-export numbers have been really messed up for a while. So what they do is they adjust them. So they adjust them, or I shouldn't say they adjust them, they change the process to exclude certain things. But then they go and they start comparing the old numbers, which weren't adjusted, to the new numbers. So you have no idea what's going on, but at the end of the day, it's okay because they looked all right, the numbers. Same thing with earnings. As long as we beat estimates, everybody's happy, not looking at what the trend of earnings has been.
It'd be kind of like, I understand what you're saying, the benchmark measurements that you're impossible to use. Like if they changed, if a pound wasn't a pound anymore, and Celsius wasn't Celsius, and Fahrenheit wasn't Fahrenheit anymore. And the same thing holds true, not just for that, but you take a look at the Dow. They put stocks in, they take stocks out. So how do you make any comparison to where the Dow is today to where it was 10, 15 years ago?
Mm-hmm.
It's different companies.
Right.
Yeah, it's not a good measurement, and even though everybody pays attention to at the end of the day, which is insanity. My thing is this, it's that If you went back and you used old inflation numbers, the ones that were using when Jimmy Carter was president, we would be in Jimmy Carter land.
Mm-hmm.
That's the reality of the situation. Those are apples to apples, oranges to oranges. My kids are in elementary school, and they're understanding common denominators and the need to use them when you are dealing with fractions. And you have to have common denominators or it's not going to work. Well, we don't have common denominators. They make it up as they go along.
So, obviously, there's nothing we can do about it besides be pissed off, bang our heads on the desk and that, because, you know, you're going to be fighting all that. But getting back to inflation and, you know, the whole idea behind, let's say, the gold trade was recently to, you know, hey, we're going to have inflation. That was the original one. We're going to have inflation, all this money printing. And that really kind of played out a bit. But it seemed like more of a momentum trade than anything else. Then we had that the government was going to default, then they're not going to default. Gold goes down, gold goes up. I mean, is there any logic right now to the whole gold situation in terms of the whole aspect of it being a material that will not fall if the U.S. dollar falls or if we do have hyperinflation?
I've never been a much of a gold bug. I mean, I've used it in my portfolio as a hedge from that time to time, as a trading vehicle. I think it's pretty dumb for people to buy a safe and stick it in their house and start filling it with gold bars. I don't think that that's a way to plan for any sort of normal retirement. I've always told people, you know, the end of the world people that, you know, Mad Max didn't need gold bars.
Yeah.
Never been on the end of the world. It's only going to happen one time.
Mm.
And again, you can't eat gold.
Yeah,
you can't eat it. Can't put it in your car. Doesn't make your car run. If that's your bet, if that's what you're believing in, go buy farmland. Buy yourself a farm. Go do something like that. I mean, that's a little bit more useful than owning a bunch of gold bars.
I have something for you to use on your radio show.
Okay.
I've been saying this for the last 5 years. My listeners know this very well. I said, instead of gold for the end of the world, tuna fish. See, what you do is you get cans of tuna fish that are packed in oil. Now, you could do a lot of things with that if it's the end of the world. First of all, you have food that can nourish you. Second of all, you can take the top off and it can be a weapon or it can be a cutting device of some sort, right? Third of all, you can use the oil and you could possibly burn it for a heating type of situation or even maybe use on your body or whatever it is. So tuna fish has some good, I think, and it can last for a very long time. I think it has some lasting use compared to gold. What do you think?
Oh, I you're not going to get any argument from me there. if you're going to do, commodities are great to have in your portfolio, but you got to have a basket of them. You can't just pick one. I mean, there's a lot of other commodities that have a much more, much better use than gold does. I mean, there's really very few industrial uses for gold.
Yeah.
So, I mean, you're going to stock up on your portfolio on that. I mean, it doesn't pay you to own it either. I mean,
yeah.
What are you going to do with a gold portfolio and you're, you know, 70 years old and retired? What are you going to do? You're going to start selling it off every month, trying to, you know, get away, shave some off the bars and go to the grocery store?
Yeah.
No, you want a portfolio that pays you to live.
Yeah, get one of those cheese slicers, you know what I mean? One of those things that you can kind of run over the top and get those real nice thin things like you do on Jarlsberg, you know, and you can use that maybe. All right, now in terms of consumer advocacy, what's going on these days that really is an alert, is something that we need to, you know, deal with and be aware of? I mean, is there anything in particular that sticks out?
The latest thing, but I mean, investment scams, like I said, world's second oldest profession. Honest to God, it's the same thing over and over again everywhere. Whether it be affinity fraud, people selling stuff through churches and their prayer groups, or, you know, another, you know, Ponzi scheme here, penny stock deal here. I mean, they never go away. People never learn because of greed and fear. One of those things ends up catching somebody, and they buy into it, and away we go. The latest little thing that I think is going to be problematic is I do think that the whole Obamacare navigators and whatnot, you're going to see various different scams pop up in regards to Obamacare. We're starting to see them now, and it's going to be easy because it is complicated as all hell, and it doesn't work. So there are going to be a lot of guys out there looking to take advantage of people in regards to Obamacare.
You know, it's interesting you mentioned that because I had a friend I talked to today, and he said he's been trying for 17 days or so, something like that, 17 days, I believe it was, to actually get on the site. And one of the things he told me was that you have to actually register in order to find out what your rates will be. Well, he's tried every day to register, and it just doesn't go through. Then finally he gets something, and it gives him a code. Then you got to make a call to somebody and get that code to them, and they can do something with it. And he called them. He says, well, I'm sorry, it doesn't work anymore. It expired. You have to get a new email. So he went and got a Yahoo email account, and he did the whole process again. And then he called, and he says, well, we didn't get your submission yet, so we can't give you information. In other words, he got the code and all that, but they didn't get it. So now this is going on and on and on. And I thought, I just thought of this as you said this. You know, somebody could put up a website and say, hey, you know, Obamacare, no lines. You know what I'm talking about? Because everybody's so backed up. And have some kind of a, you know, fraud or at least a trick on the consumer as to what they're doing there, because everybody's so frustrated with the fact that they can't get online and get the information.
Yeah. No, that's going to happen. Whether it be Obamacare expediters, fake expediters, or what, they're going to pop up. I mean, state of Florida, Medicare fraud is bigger than the cocaine trade. I mean, Crockett and Tubbs would be chasing after illegal walkers if they redid the show today. Let's just be honest. It's a bit of a problem down here.
Yeah, well, I do understand. I'm not too far away from you. All right, so in terms of the Fed, we talked about that, and we have Janet Yellen coming in right now. In terms of how this is all presented and the whole confidence game that we're providing, or the Fed is providing, to the markets, that if it's bad news, it's not so bad because we got the Fed. If it's good news, well, it's good news. And the communication tool, by the way, which nobody wants to say what it is, communication is nothing more than verbal manipulation of the markets by promising kind of a horse and a carrot kind of thing. Mm-hmm. We're the horse. And is there an end to this? Is this something that's going to continue around the world? How should consumers be dealing with this?
With the money printing?
Well, the money printing and the whole way of verbally manipulating the markets. I hate using the word manipulating. It sounds so negative. But verbally molding and shaping market sentiment.
Well, I mean, I don't care about short-term market sentiment. I mean, like this whole debt ceiling thing, and the market was down, you know, 600-700 points. I was like, okay, time to buy some more.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you could get freaked out over stuff. I mean, everybody thought the world was going to end when the Dow was down at 6,600, and I was like, woohoo, sweet.
Yeah,
I know. What a great menu we've got going on here. Stocks on sale. May not see this ever again in my lifetime, this type of a sale. It's a problem. Is people are too short-term in their thinking.
Well, is that because of the likes of, let's say, I mean, really, is there any other news channels out there that deal with finance?
Listen, if CNBC were to actually do the right thing by, you know, investors and actually do the right thing, they wouldn't have the 24 hours worth of programming. That's the problem. Mm-hmm. They've got to make news up. But this is true of all these 24-hour news networks, and it's a problem. Can anybody tell me anything good that's come out of all these? I mean, whether it be Fox, MSNBC, any of these things? The original was the best one. The CNN for a half an hour.
Oh,
and if anything changed, they would let you know.
They still have it on NPR, obviously. They have the NPR wrap. That's not bad, actually. Or, you know, if you really want to get the lowdown, you really want to get the guts of it all and find out what's happening with the truth, I mean, you just listen to my podcast. So there you go.
There you go.
So it's all good. All right, listen, what else do you have to impart to us? I mean, what else things should we be looking at into the future? How about the housing market? Scams, issues, concerns?
Well, I mean, we're right back where we were before. The government's subsidizing subprime loans again, and that the FHA needs $1 billion-plus bailout. Nobody's really talking about that. And also the federal government is changing the rules and laws in regards to your local community zoning. The federal government can now come into your community and say that your community is not diverse enough and you need to have more affordable housing, you need to have this and that, and they can change the zoning laws for your community. The long arm of Washington, D.C. getting into our business even further.
So you're saying affirmative action for your community?
Yes, yes.
Really?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
How does that happen?
Yeah, well, it happened. They rewrote the regulations in D.C., and they're going to start doing that. They're going to start going. If they feel a community is not the way that they want to have that community set up, they can do that. And this also offers another way for them to shake down communities, if you think about it.
Yeah, I mean, it seems to me that I wasn't aware, by the way, that, well, first of all, if somebody wants to buy a house, they buy a house. But what you're saying is if the overall structure of the community doesn't balance right from a mathematical equation of particular races and all that, religions, I don't know, whatever they're using, that they may say, no, that house can't be sold to that party?
Well, no, they can change zoning laws in the way the area is zoned. They have it's HUD, it's Department of Housing and Urban Development. It's called the Affirmatively furthering fair housing. It's in the Federal Register. This allows for the agency to come into your municipality and dismantle any local zoning rules they see fit so they can make your neighborhood, in their infinite wisdom, fairer.
And these these are the same people that cannot actually put a budget together for 4 years. Is that the same people?
Listen, I mean, we could complain about this till we're blue in the face, but you get the government you deserve. If people are still dumb enough to put these same people into office, what are you going to do? I mean, I could be ranting and raving for 14 years on my radio show to try to explain to people. I rip into Republicans just as bad as I rip into Democrats, because they're just as bad in regards to the way that they want to spend and the things that they want to do. Yet nobody cares, and you keep putting these people into office. You know, what are you going to do? I mean, what can you do? It's a Sisyphean battle.
Yeah, yeah. And if you were here, you see I am blue in the face, actually. I'm like a little one of those little guys from TV, the Smurfs. Anyway, listen, I want to thank you for joining us and, imparting some of your wisdom. And, of course, people can listen to you on the TRN network. And also check you out at watchdogonwallstreet.com. We'll make sure to put links to that on the show notes. And, of course, is Chris Markowski. And I appreciate your coming along.
No, it's my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
All right, we'll do it again. Thanks. Hey, that was good. I want to talk really quickly about last week and some of the things that people had been saying and about the interview last week and the guest and all that. And I want to really kind of just very quickly go over this. There was a lot of emails. Well, not a lot. There was a few emails that came in. And there was a discussion that they were very disappointed that the debate, the conversation, the interview went, really nowhere in terms of really battling our guest, and that was John Perkins, on some of the things that he had said and some of maybe the inaccuracies about Congress and about some of the various matters about what he went into. You know, here's the thing, that what I try to do as a host is to bring on people, let them express their side of the story, have a conversation with them, allow them to flush it out. Yeah, sometimes if there's something really awry and I can, get to it right off right out of my head and kind of go through it, then what I'll do? I'll push them on it and I'll say, hey, wait a minute, what about this? And, put a little debate into it. Now, last week I was a little stunned in some of the things that he was saying and really about the gent that I knew from his books and from past interviews. And frankly, I did fall down on that, and I should have been a little bit stronger in my discussion with him, and maybe I should have been a little bit more of throwing some of the items that he had out there and really attacked him on it, or at least, bantered back and forth on what he had said. But I feel that also my audience is pretty sophisticated and have a lot of knowledge and a lot of opinion of their own, and you could figure out what's going on. You don't need me to spoon-feed you and tell you, hey, you know what? This guy is full of this, or this guy is wrong. You could do a good job of that. And again, I'm here as a conduit to bring the people on to hopefully shed some light on things, not only for me, but for you as well. So I do understand, though, that there was some disappointment in that, and I do apologize for that. And, if that happens again, do me a favor, call me out on it. I appreciate it. All right, let's talk about a few things that I wanted to go through. China's GDP came in at about 7.8% we saw last week, and everybody was pretty excited about that. One of the big things that you'll notice is that with that number, you're starting to see things like the material stocks, which we talked about a few weeks ago, how they may see some upside here because of the rotation that would go on and the fact that, they haven't gone out of business as of yet, and maybe there's some value in some of these stocks. So with that, you did see not only the market move and be favorable towards this, but also, and I think you saw some of the materials and the materials sector do very nicely. And I talked about that on DH Unplugged last week. We talked about Cliffs and U.S. Steel, and Nucor came out with earnings that weren't terrible as that were expected. So that's good, and you may see additional rotation into this sector because they have been so unloved for a while. Think about what happened with Facebook, for example, and how the tide changed very, very quickly. So keep these on your radar screen. Make a list of the DuPonts. Make a list of the Monsantos, the Cleveland Cliffs CLF, the U.S. Steel, maybe Freeport-McMoRan, et cetera. See how they play out and if there is any movement on the upside, or if this recent rally that we saw with them from a very low base is going to fizzle. But I do think that the potential for a lot of catch-up end of year, and for the fact that they haven't gone out of business, and some of these other names seem a little bit pricey right now, as does the market itself. Seems to be pretty pricey in terms of the future earnings and the current earnings. So you may have something there. I'll also mention that the VIX, which was as high as 20 last week when the debt ceiling debate continued to rage on, dropped from about close to 20 to about 13. That is astounding. In other words, we go from fear in the context of the current environment of 20, which is very high, again, current environment, to a 13, which is euphoria in a matter of 3 days. That's unbelievable. You might want to check out some of the VIX proxies, even though you only want to stay in there for a period of time, not too long. But I would say that there is an opportunity with any kind of disappointment on earnings or economics, that the potential for a rise in the VIX from here, and especially because we did only just push out the decision on the budget and the debt ceiling for a few months, you may see that it holds here. Now, it did go down to, I think, under 13 for a little while there, but I would say that, you know, it may not be one day, it may not be, you know, just the next, it may not be Wednesday, but you're going to start to see potentially a normalization of the VIX over time. The other thing is that the KRI indicator, the key reversal indicator, on Friday hit a 5. It ended at a 4, a plus 4. Now, when you get into the plus 4, the plus 5, the negative 4, the negative 5, negative 6, you're starting to get into very significant readings on an overheated or an oversold market condition. And when you have that reading of a plus 5, you're starting to see that things are getting pretty frothy. And time and time again, we've seen this. And what has happened is that you look for a very imminent turn opposite the direction the trend is, which you could say is up right now. It went from a downtrend to an uptrend in a matter, again, of 3 days, just like the move on the VIX. But when you look at that and you see what's happened and the amount of buying pressure that was involved in the markets, you may see a little bit more follow through here. But I wouldn't be surprised if the necessary cooling that comes along with very high readings or very low readings does play into the next week, especially with all of the particular economic reports that we have coming. In addition to that, last Friday was the expiration of options. You know, the third Friday of the month is Options X, and you did see some good volume come in there. And at the same time, we have seen that the VIX has had a habit of selling off at that period and then rising a bit after, and especially if it did a big move. And it could be the role of the VIX, it could be the contracts themselves, it could be a combination of that and the better numbers from Google, and at the same time from Verizon. And also potentially it could be that you have Janet Yellen coming in and the Fed being pretty persistent in their $85 billion per month of buying altogether. Put that all in a big bowl and mix it together, chop it up, and what do you have? You have complacency and little reason to be too worried, supposedly. Okay, that's good. But at the same time, markets are cyclical in nature and trees don't grow to the sky. So I think that you have to look at that big move, which is a surprise to a lot of people, and potentially a significant amount of short covering that came in there after the agreement was made by the government and then pushed even more once you breached the upper levels of the all-time high range for various indices. And that caused all sorts of movement to really get out of whack. So I think that when we consider that we have a environment of very easy money, very easy liquidity, or a lot of liquidity, not only from the U.S. but around the world, you have to look at it and say, you know what, I understand why the fear factor is down, but at the same time realize that there are still a lot of headwinds. We still don't have a complete picture of what's going on in China. We don't know how good those numbers are. The real estate market, with the current the numbers that we've seen between the NAHB numbers and the housing numbers and the rising, although recently coming down, interest rate environment, All those are starting to throw a little bit of a question into the sustainability of a further advance on housing prices and recovery. And, you know, you put that all into that same mixture. Now you can see a little bit of a different story that we may have reached a recent high. And then we have to question how much the government shutdown hurt the economy, hurt spending that won't recover. And, of course, all the other potential problems that we'll see with the next government issue that is going to surely come up in, I would say, December, January-ish, depending on how fast they want to get ahead of things, which is usually not. They usually want to do things at the last minute and have all this drama, it seems. So take a look at the different stocks we talked about. I'll kind of rattle them off real quickly again. We talked about Rockwell Holdings, ROK, CMG, Google, CLF. We talked about the VIX, VXX, and some of the proxies or maybe even the direct options in that area. We talked about CLF, I mentioned, X, Freeport-McMoRan, and a few others in the material sector as well. Or just look at the materials ETF. That would be something to look at as well as an interesting opportunity to buy into. And I would also say that some of the stocks that had been having tough quarters where the analysts had decreased their earnings estimates have done very well. Look at Align, ALGN, on Friday. They make the Invisalign. I've liked that company. We're not in it right now, but they make the Invisalign, which is the orthodontics for braces that are being used around the world pretty well and very much liked by people because they're less invasive and have less of a, I guess, of a braces look when you smile. That stock went up, I think, 24% on Friday. Take a look at that chart. Pretty interesting chart where they had a couple disappointing quarters. Stock came down like crazy and then just ramped up this quarter after they had a decent number and put better than expected guidance out there. So that was kind of interesting. The other thing you have to think about is what's going to happen with healthcare now. I'm not even suggesting that the Republicans will, in fact, have any kind of teeth to whatever they do. Forget all that. Forget the politics. But as we are now entering into a time when there is the implementation of the new Affordable Care Act, there is now the question of what is the profitability of these various vendors, whether it is the hospitals, the HMOs, the pharmacy companies, the medical supply companies. You know, go down the list of all the different potential players that are affected by this, and then what? Athena Health had another spectacular day after similar situation to Align, where they had a couple of quarters that really weren't as good. Expectations were lowered, and they had a nice number, and the stock just flew when their earnings came out. On the other hand, you see a company like the Select Comfort, which makes the mattresses, something that I've always been very hesitant about. They put out a number and really, really brought down their guidance, and the stock was down 22%. On that. Now, I picked up and looked at shorting Tempur-Pedic, and the stock was down in sympathy about 7% or so the night that, in the after hours that the stock was getting killed, the Select Comfort. And the next day, it came back, and it was down about 5% or so. Okay, so we got into a position on that, and the next day it was up. So the stock is only down about 2%. After a kissing cousin of theirs got obliterated. And you have to wonder what's going to happen there. And the closer you get to earnings on that company, are there going to be as many people trying to play that to the upside? There's some differences. There's some features of the companies that are different. So some of the things that are affecting Select Comfort may not be affecting the other companies like Mattress Firm or possibly Tempur-Pedic, but I would say that if, in fact, we've seen a little bit of a slowdown comparatively in the incredible move in housing and the buying activity, and people are doing a little bit more of holding on to their wallets, and we did see that in several of the last couple of updates of consumer confidence by the various companies that do it, we did see a slip in that. You know, you have to wonder if there is the potential for continuing problems in the mattress industry and some of the, we'll say, the tertiary industries within the home area, in the home real estate and home builders slash suppliers. So We're gonna put a wrap on it right there, and I hope you do join me on DH Unplugged this week. DH Unplugged is every Wednesday. We have the game, the closest to the pin, we can win. I think next week is a $50 Amex gift card that is going out to the winner of that for the following week, and we give away books, and we give away Trigger Point Research subscriptions, cool stuff. John Dvorak and myself talk, and we have a great time doing it about all sorts of things. Make sure to join us there. And, of course, just as a quick announcement, I don't think I mentioned this, that the key reversal indicator is going to be available. It's really cool, too. We did a really nice job on this, I think. And they designed it really well, the developers that we use. And it is, I think, probably one of the neatest indicators because it has a great dial. It all coordinates. It's gradients to tell you exactly where things are. And this is the kind of thing you use for strictly... Well, two things. One would be if you want to strictly do market timing and you want to find out where those levels of exaggeration appear on a particular index, and you can use this for pretty much the markets in general, even though we use one specific index for it. And then the second thing is you can kind of see, okay, well, if the markets are getting really frothy, what do I do in that? And it comes with a commentary on every single move that it makes. Very cool. It's available on TradeStation very shortly, so take a look at that. And if you have any questions on that, just go over to triggercharts.com. I want to thank you for joining me. Thank my guests, of course. And, of course, if you do want to get in touch with me about this show, just write to askandrew@thedisciplinedinvestor.com. I'll see you next week. Thanks a lot for joining me.
The Disciplined Investor Podcast is sponsored in part by Horowitz & Company, a registered investment advisor and money manager. The information presented in this podcast is not intended to be used as the sole basis of any investment decisions, nor should it be construed as advice designed to meet the investment needs of any particular investor. Some discussion contains forward-looking statements which are based on current expectations and differences can be expected. The Disciplined Investor's host, Andrew Horowitz, is a certified financial planner and registered investment advisor, regulated in various states. None of the information presented should be construed as an offer to sell or buy any particular security. As always, use your best judgment when investing.